If you're listening to this, then you likely already know that being an independent musician can be a lonely road. And maybe your friends and your family just don't fully understand why you do what you do or why you invest so much time, energy, and money towards achieving your music goals. And especially early on, it can be hard to find people who really understand what you're trying to accomplish and how to make it happen. So that's where Modern Musician comes in. My name is Michael Walker, and you know, I can understand and relate to that feeling. I've been there myself, and so has our team of independent artists. And the truth is that basically everything good in my life has been the result of music. It's the reason I met my wife. It's why I have my three kids. It's how I met my best friends. And now with Modern Musician, we've seen so many talented artists who started out with a dream, with a passion, but without really a fan base, without a business, and be able to take that and turn it into a sustainable full-time career and be able to impact hundreds of thousands, even millions of fans with their music. And we've had thousands of messages from artists who've told us that we've helped change their lives forever. And it just gets even more exciting, fulfilling when you're surrounded by a community of other people who get it and who share their success and their knowledge with each other openly. And so if you are feeling called to make your music a full-time career and to be able to reach more people with your music, then I want to invite you to join our community so that we can support your growth and help lift you up as you pursue your musical dreams. You'll be able to interact in a community with other high-level artists, coaches, and industry professionals, as well as be able to participate in our daily live podcasts, meet these amazing guests, and get access to completely free training. If you'd like to join our family of artists who truly care about your success, then click on the link in the show notes and sign up now.
This is why it's just so complicated. It's hard to get it all down. You almost just need to know that if someone hits play on my song, five different ways I get paid. Am I set up to collect all five? If I control all five, collecting that is where Audium comes in.
It's easy to get lost in today's music industry with constantly changing technology and where anyone with a computer can release their own music. But I'm going to share with you why this is the best time to be an independent musician, and it's only getting better. If you have high quality music, but you just don't know the best way to promote yourself so that you can reach the right people and generate a sustainable income with your music, we're going to show you the best strategies that we're using right now to reach millions of new listeners every month without spending 10 hours a day on social media. We're creating a revolution in today's music industry, and this is your invitation to join me. I'm your host, Michael Walker. All right, so I'm excited to be here today with John Rasso. So John is the CEO of Audium, which is a YouTube digital publishing royalties collection specialization company within CSAC Music Services. And, you know, there's so much complexity, so many things that are happening underneath the hood to make sure that you as musicians are fairly compensated and you're paid for your music. And I think for a lot of us, you know, I know myself included, it's a world that can be difficult to navigate around. And it's really important, you know, to be able to have a service that allows us to, you know, collect on those royalties. So John, thank you for taking the time to come on here live and maybe help to demystify a little bit of the experience for us as musicians, just to know, you know, what do we need to know to really be able to fully utilize this?
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, no, this is complicated. This is why we exist, because it is not, we've migrated from a musician that got to be a musician to now a musician that needs to be a business person and a lawyer. And be like seven in their own label and their own music publisher and their own marketing person. So it's a lot. And I think people learn that right away. And I think it's great to learn this sooner the better. Until there's money to fight over, it's better to have the money that someone could fight over rather than fighting over money that someone else has. So, you know, I think it's incredibly important to learn this. And it's complicated. I mean, it's a muscle that if I don't use it, I lose it. Like, you know, it is very complicated. And I'm just in the publishing piece, really.
So. Cool. Well, I'm definitely interested in, I'm looking forward to connecting more and hearing more about how, you know, how it works, but also, yeah, to hear your thoughts on where things are at right now with, you know, the direction things are headed with AI in the music industry and music generation. How does that affect, you know, royalties and whatnot? But before we dive in, maybe you could quickly introduce yourself for those of us here who this is their first time connecting with you. Maybe you could share a little bit about your story and how you connected with Audium.
Sure. I've, you know, been a huge music fan my entire life. Very quickly, I learned that my best instrument was the telephone. And as a result, I became the person that put the infrastructure together for high school bands. I did the bookings. I put together tours, you know, things that I literally was like, let's go on the road and, you know, and put a band out for 6 weeks, not knowing where they're going to be, maybe more than a week and a half, 2 weeks out, you know, figuring out what the local radio station was, the local record store, where the other bands were, like, to get it. So it was really just baptism by fire. And I'm going on literally 40 years of doing this. So it started early and often, and certainly the world has changed. And I've been lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time, not to be left behind with the digital revolution that really started in the mid 90s. At the time I was with Time Warner, Atlantic Records was you know, one entity, and I had people there that literally were the first people to build things on the World Wide Web. So moving from, you know, news feeds and, you know, putting in commands to do, you know, green screen stuff to the graphical interface that we're having our phones now before those phones existed. So I was just very lucky enough to not miss the wave and ride it in and learn it as people did. Now, I certainly have been surpassed in the depths of knowledge of that, but I also had the previous world information to adopt to it. So I've been pretty lucky to be just in the right place at the right time. So, and here I am. I'm not selling, you know, high-end cars or real estate like some of the other people I knew in the music business in the 90s. So, so that's been my background. And I've moved from record labels to early .coms that we would burn and ship you CDs before there was bandwidth to download a song. I then ended up at a consulting firm that we did a lot of work to build the infrastructure at ASCAP, and then the Harry Fox Agency, which has now evolved over the years through acquisitions by CSAC to them acquiring the company that I now run called Audium, which specializes in certainly a source of royalties that didn't exist, you know, 15 years ago, which was, you know, user generated video content. Karaoke Pelotons, the fitness, all of those things where music is used and impossible to keep track of. But through what we do and the individual giving us the data, we're able to track down and keep track of your royalties. So that's what I'm hoping to talk a little more about during our conversation.
Cool. Yeah, that's super interesting. And yeah, I love the perspective that you bring from, you know, like you said, over 40 years of experience, and you sort of witnessing the before and after of this wave with, you know, the digitalization of the internet. And I'm curious to get your perspective on how you were able to best leverage that opportunity. Like, one analogy that comes to mind is that we're kind of like surfers, and, you know, when there's these waves, we have this opportunity where if we kind of swim along with it or we catch it in the right time, that can really kind of boost your momentum. And it's tempting to try to catch a wave that passed, like, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, but you have to kind of sense what's the current wave right now. And even though it hasn't necessarily like panned out yet, there's an opportunity to like swim along with it. So for things like, you know, AI for musicians, I think it's an interesting wave that they could potentially catch. But I'm just curious to hear your perspective from, you know, witnessing and being a part of that evolution. What's your advice for, you know, a musician right now that's interested in learning how to catch the wave?
Well, I mean, to follow your analogy, I mean, it's just like that. You can't swim against the current, right? You get the undertow will take you, and, you know, it's like you will be more successful by, you know, going with the flow rather than fighting the flow. I mean, arguably, that's exactly what happened with the digital revolution. The record labels fought, you know, the Napsters of the world, and yet here we are, you know, and they're making a huge fortune. I mean, the thing that they were able to ride through is the fact is they owned these catalogs, but they fought it being a legal option. But it's what the audience wanted, right? At the end of the day, is we music exists by the demand for it. And that's where there's no financial success in this business by delivering something that people don't want. Now, you might be able to hang around long enough where you've made music that is so ahead of its time that, you know, you have a victory lap, you know, 20 years later because you were, oh, how'd you know digital, you know, electronic music of the 70s was not a big money making scenario, but, you know, it is the basis of all music really now. So, but you have to feed yourself for the 40 years in between. But generally, like AI, it's funny. It's kind of, I mean, AI is a specific thing, but it's kind of the same thing over and over again. Going back 100+ years, the fact that radio, broadcast radio was going to destroy music. What would you ever, making records? Oh my God, what is a live performer going to do? No one's ever going to, television was going to, or movies were going to be ruined by television. So it's always, there's always going to be a sky is falling moment. But in reality, the market, you can't fight the demand. It's how people want to consume it. I mean, I'm one of them too. It's like people are like, oh, I remember when you used to have to, you'd listen to an album, then you get up and turn it over and you couldn't like skip ahead without getting, and it's like, but ironically, that experience has come back in a big way because people do appreciate music that way. Because at the same time, Rick, now streaming has made short songs valuable, right? It's like, TikTok even more so, right? I need a hook that works in a 30, 45 second piece, right? It's this push and pull. So you just recognize and you do. And then ironically, the laws of copyright don't change quick enough that they get eaten by all this. So frequently there is a push pull of the creative market who is essentially violating the law, right? Like even YouTube, it was not legally correct when it went live. It was just like anybody using any copy or sampling, right? And eventually there was a push and pull, and there was an equilibrium on both sides of how do we monetize it. And in some cases, it's good and bad. People still argue that, so and so says I can't use their sample. They're ruining my great creative, but your great creative is using their copyright, shoe on the other foot. It's the old, you can't drive my car. I can't believe you won't let me drive your car. I need to get someplace and your car's right here. And I even have the keys to it. Right. It's like, but it's my car. I get to decide that. Mm-hmm. So I think it very quickly, I kind of learned, I sort of exited the record label, the big record labels at a good time in the late 90s. So I was kind of part of the right side of the argument that won in the long run, rather than, oh my gosh, I need to protect my bread and butter and make sure that you can't buy the single of that one song and you have to spend $16 on the CD and buy the 12 other crappy songs to get that one song you like, because that kind of manipulation, people catch on. People aren't stupid. And they're, in the end of the day, that's what that was the driver that created Napster. Like I want this one song I really like, And so, lots of examples there, but you see what I'm saying? So an AI is just another thing, right? There's violation of copyright. If an AI, Taylor Swift comes out, right? You can't, that's not legal. There is legal ramifications of doing that. Now there might be some artistic reasons to do it, and then you do have some artists that embrace it in the same way. Okay, I'm not going to make money by shutting someone down from making an AI version of me out there, but it will make me much more famous and sell the things I do make money on. It's always a moving target of where your financial piece is. You go on the road. And it's like, oh, I need to sell tickets. I make money selling tickets. But then you find out, I make a hell of a lot more money selling t-shirts and physical product at the shows. So what if my shows were free and I would get 500 people and 150 of them would buy shirts, whereas if I charged $5, I would only, 20 people would buy shirts. So it becomes just like any business of where is it value to me? What do you give away? What's the tease to make the certain thing? So you, especially now that we're all creators, have so much control, or really there's no one else who's investing without taking a big enough. That's the way you kind of have to think of your place in the world. It's like, what is financially valuable, and doesn't impede on my creative process, that I make the product that I want to make and I reach the people that I want to reach. And you hear about the super fan. Like if you have a couple thousand people that will pay, hundreds of dollars a year, that you make a living. It's not about, oh, I need to get a penny from a billion people. That's a harder market to reach and a rarer thing. Whereas, so it's in your genre, your market. So you see, there's so many ways to slice and dice it. And I think if you keep that open mind, that's the secret of not getting you know, shut out all of your eggs in one basket kind of scenario where, you know, I'm all in on telephone booths. And then what's a telephone booth?
Yeah, that business isn't really booming right now, is it? Telephone booths. Awesome. Yeah, there's so much good stuff there. So you talked about the idea of demand, really, like of looking at where's the market demand. And it seems like that is such a core principle of business in general. And us as musicians, if we want to have a successful business, we need to figure out, you know, where can we provide the most value to our fans, and not fighting the demand, not fighting the tidal wave, but like, you know, swimming along with the demands so that we can, you know, get the momentum from catching the wave. Awesome. It's interesting. What that reminds me of is right now, it seems like a lot of our artists, where they're generating the bulk of their revenue, is from higher end experiences that are things like private concerts or house concerts or custom songs or these things that are like, you know, at the high end of the market, and people are willing to pay for them, versus, you know, streaming, where you get paid a fraction of a penny per stream. And like you said, you need millions or a lot of streams in order to make it pay. So maybe circling back around here to, you know, Audium and royalties and sort of like the core basics of for an artist who is here, who's an independent artist who is in the camp that you described, like they have 10 different hats that they're wearing and they're just trying to figure out like, what's the minimum that I can know in order to not be losing out on, you know, all of this, you know, the potential revenue that I could be generating. How do you recommend they start out?
So it's pretty straightforward. There's the established means of generating royalties, and what is, while it's, some of it's not very old, is sort of the traditional method. I've made a sound recording, I've written a song in which that sound recording is performed on, whether or not you're the performer or not, but let's assume you are completely self-contained. You've recorded everything yourself. You own your sound recording. You don't have a label. You haven't signed a publishing deal with anybody, so you're self-published. And you all think about all the different pieces you need to put together. Like, your music does not make it to any of these streaming services unless you've engaged a sound recording distributor, right? Whether it's a DistroKid or a TuneCore type of scenario, or right. So you have to get it there, right? That's the piece. Then that one's pretty straightforward because your sound recordings are simple. Like, you own it all and it comes right back to you. You're, because of the way the law works, and historically, the music publishing piece of it needs to flow through multiple different places. So this is kind of the nature of the beast of the history of it. I think it was chopped up because everyone wanted a piece. And if things started today, it wouldn't be as sliced and diced as it is, but that is the reality of the law, and also the infrastructure that is looking to protect itself too, as well as, you know, those existing businesses around it. So first of all, so now let's say your song is on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, audio only streaming, right? You know where their sound recordings are coming from. That share is coming back through the digital distributor that you hired to get it there. Now, the publishing piece, there are multiple pieces of it. There is what's called the mechanical, which is literally goes back to the days of when you make a piano roll or a 78 shellac or a cassette tape, or even, you know, not too long ago, even though they're getting old now, is a download. Like, it, you fixed that recording in some means of delivery. And the U.S. government has set up what is called a statutory rate, and it's a compulsory license, meaning you, since you wrote it, you get to record it. You get to decide who records it first, and you've done it yourself, and you put it in the marketplace. Once you put it in the marketplace, anyone can cover your song without your permission, but they have to pay this statutory rate. So in this case, the streaming service has to pay that statutory rate for every single composition that is embodied in one of the sound recordings out there. And this is music too. So we're not, sound effects don't have the same thing, but, or nature sounds or whatever. So this is music. So on a streaming service in the United States, there is something that is called the Mechanical Licensing Collective, which has only been in existence for about 5 years now. And it sort of solved the problem, as there's all these different streaming services and I need to make an arrangement to get my publishing. known to each one of these services. So it's been aggregated into this single thing called the Mechanical Licensing Collective. And you need to make sure your compositions are registered there. And you tell them that I know this person performed the song. It might be yourself. And then probably through your digital distributor, you're aware that there is a what's called an ISRC code, which is issued by that company usually. That is a unique identifier for your sound recording. So you want to deliver that to these places so that they know when they get, so that when Mechanical Licensing Collective is told by Spotify, hey, this song has been played 15,000 times, they know, oh, this sound recording of XYZ is actually of this composition, XYZ. And it's, since song titles are not unique, that it's this particular composition with the title Sunshine or whatever that needs to be reported to. And then the Mechanical Licensing Collective does a rate calculation based on the royalties. That's a complexity you could really go down, but you really don't need to know. Just that every single month there is a different rate, which is a percentage of all the revenue they've collected. And that money is then accounted to the MLC's members, right? So you could, as a publisher, you could sign up directly with the MLC, or you could use a service like an Audium, who are able to sort of filter, you know, make sure you come to Audium. Audium will make sure your music is in all of the different services. I'm using the streaming services right now, which is the MLC, but there's also YouTube. Like, YouTube doesn't have the same level of access as like anybody could join the MLC, whereas YouTube, you need a certain tier to do it, and Audium has achieved that tier. There's also direct deals with companies like Peloton. There is direct deals with, so there's all these places. So Audium just includes the MLC, but the MLC you could actually do yourself. So you could always go and check, and it's always worth checking out the MLC.com. And so that's a pretty straightforward one, right? At this point, it used to be far more complicated. You need to know 12 different places. But so that is your audio only streaming in the United States. So, and like I said, that's the easy one. Now, yeah, Audium also has
like
this,
like two components to that, though. So there was like the DistroKid or TuneCore, and then,
well,
then there's also
so that's the sound recording. This is the MLC has nothing to do with the sound recording itself. Let's put it this way: your music won't even be on any of those services unless you've engaged one of them. I mean, there's hundreds at this point, I guess, of digital services that will, you know, with a credit card and a login, will make your information about it, right? There's all the major labels have it. If you have a record deal, I mean, there's companies. So part of the CSEC Music Group, we have a company called Audio Salad, which does that. And they've been a very big indie organization, and they're slowly opening the door to sort of more walk-up stuff. But right now it's like, you know, they have companies like Secretly Canadian and, you know, that size of
it's a nice name for a company. Labels.
Yeah, exactly.
Wouldn't want anyone to know.
Yeah. But that I believe that was a label that started out of a college dorm in Indianapolis. So, or in Indiana somewhere. I won't go down that road. Anyway.
That's what they want you to think, at least.
Yes, exactly. But secretly. So that's the sound recording piece. Generally, we're able to provide that if you come to Audium and you're interested in distribution within the CSEC Music Services. Like I said, we have digital distribution services as well. But that's we have a full service of things that a creator would need, including digital distribution. We even have a service that will pay if you have a stable of songwriters, or you have a record label with a stable of artists, and you need the songwriters accounted to, or the individual artists accounted to for the royalties. We know it's not a one size fits all, whereas Audium is much more about, I know what to do with my records. This publishing thing is a little complicated. I may even have joined the MLC, but I know that someone is using my music in a Peloton, spin class, or, there's companies like LyricFind that use, you know, that get lyrics around all, through the digital services and monetize those. TikTok itself is another one, right? Like, there's all these different places that are not, oh, I'm just going to go and collect my publishing royalties. And that's where Audium becomes a one-stop shop where we have all the knowledge, we have all the access, we have the licenses, and we have the relationships in place. So you could come and sign up with us. And so for a percentage of your royalties, and it's pretty small, smaller than probably any publishing deal you'd do, and you retain your ownership, you're able to not have to worry about that. You know, there is someone out there. As soon as I write a song and I tell them, you go in and you tell us you wrote this song, we are the ones that go forward and make sure everybody where that song could be used knows it's yours, and they need to account to Audium, and then Audium accounts to you every single month. So it's kind of, once again, it's sort of your back office. Like, instead of hiring a publishing person in-house for a small percentage of that, you have the dozen experts at Audium doing it for you for a percentage of what you earn, right? So if you earn a ton of money, we get a piece of your ton of money. If you don't earn a lot of money, you don't have to worry about it, but you're still getting, you know, 80, 85% of your royalties. So it's sort of a good transition. And then if someone comes along and you've decided that you want to sign a public, like Universal Music Publishing wants to, you know, give you a big check and you want to sign up with them, Audium doesn't impede that in any way. You still own it and you've been accounted to. But, you know, that's a whole other thing is, do you want to sell anything? Like, do you want to sell your kids? Do you want your kids to get a college education first? And then, boy, my kid's going to be much more valuable after he's got the college education versus, you know, the drooling applesauce that he is as a 1-year-old, you know? So that's a horrible analogy, but you know what I'm saying? It is, they are your songs, and so they're very meaningful. So
is there a reason that people have kids and it's not that they're looking to sell them later on in life?
Well, it's sort of a cross analogy, right? People always talk about, what's your favorite song you wrote? Well, they're like my kids, but you know, this is, so it's sort of an extension of that, but,
It makes sense. So, I mean, you know, if you have an appreciating asset, then you don't want to put yourself in a corner where, like, you know, if you expect that you're going to grow, which hopefully you do, you know, if you're looking to grow your career, then those are assets are going to increase in value. So that's great that, you know, you have that flexibility.
And to this day, you hear about like people who like, you know, big, I heard, who was it? It was either like Daryl Hall or somebody saying how they regret selling any part of their cut. Like, it's, you know, it looked great at the time, but you know, wow, you know, I sold it 5 years ago for $25 million and now I could have gotten $75 million for it. And what did I do? Nothing. I could have held on to it. And it's not like I wasn't making money, you know, it's sort of when you do it, you know, it's, you know, some people it's their estate planning. Bob Dylan's like, you know, it's much easier for me to divide up $500 million against my heirs than it is to go, hey, here, you manage like a Rolling Stone. You know, it's a very different business. Is it going to be Dylan and Sons, or is it going to be, here's a chunk of change, kid, you go do your, what you do. Yeah. So a lot of different pieces there, but So going back to the Audium piece, that's part of it is we like to see ourselves as we're like the music publishing mechanics, right? You don't necessarily know how to fix the car when you bring it to the mechanic. You want to trust them. You want to believe that you're getting a fair price and that when the work is done, that you're getting what you want. But at the same time, I don't need to, you know what, if I might think I know a lot about fixing a carburetor in a car and, you know, but not enough to do it myself, or I know enough to keep you honest, I just don't have the time, you know? So there's varying degrees of knowledge of our clients too. But you know, we work for thousands of publishers. We have a million copyrights we represent from legends like the Chuck Berry catalog down to, you know, with DJ Muggs, the DJ with, you know, House of Pain and Cypress Hill. So who was, you know, sampled to this day and is putting out new music, to, you know, a kid who just wrote his first song and it's up on YouTube and he wants to make sure he's collecting his money and, or his viral TikTok, piece is getting his fair due. Now, I can't help you with how much money they actually make, but at the end of the day is we certainly make sure that that if anybody else is claiming your song, that we get them off the song, that if no one's claiming your song, that you are claiming your song. So there's all these different things that certainly take a lot of time and effort, you know, resolving conflicts. And because we have relationships with all these different publishers in the marketplace, we're able to get those resolved pretty quickly. or at least get them locked up so it's not flowing until it gets resolved. So I don't know how much more detail you want me to go into here, but there's so many things that just, it's like tomorrow there might be a new service, and one of the things they will want to do is, we want the songs that are in the Audium catalog, and they will come to us, and we will make sure those songs are registered in the database they're using. And so, you know, when a new service launches in 2 months, when that starts earning money, it comes through. I mean, we do it all the time, and they never make any money because they're great ideas or bad ideas, and they never find a market. But, you know, those are the things that become TikTok, that become Peloton, that become, you know, there's all these guitar tablature services, like all the different, like Fender has one. There's a company called Ultimate Guitar, and all of those things. Anytime someone pulls up your song to learn how to play it and look up the tablature, that generates revenue, and it doesn't go anywhere if you're not there making the claims. And frankly, it's just impossible to do if you're also making the music. And so that's where I think we come in.
Mm. Amazing. Yeah, I'm so grateful for services like Audium. Like, I'm imagining for us musicians, if we had to manually go out and handle all of these ourselves, like, there just would not be enough time in the day. So, it sounds like best way to dive in would be to go to audium.com and, you know, explore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's an application to fill out. And so you go through the form there. That'll essentially let you know whether or not it's like, you know, doing business with us, you want to have enough traction that it's worth doing or whatever. You know, it's at some point you need to have a little going on. So it's, you know, there's something to capture. But at the same time, yeah, some of the questions we ask will probably be very helpful. And I always recommend people that there's a book by Donald Passman that you must mention to people too, called Everything About the Music Business. It's a really great, like, you could skim the top or you could go deep on it. And it's really, every musician should at least have a basic knowledge of all the different legalities and where your money comes from and what questions to ask when you're looking to build your team. Like to know if a manager is knowledgeable enough to help you, not just because his dad knows somebody. You know, sometimes it's the best you can do, but at the same time, you want to make sure that they'll actually be helpful rather than just take your money when you earn it.
Mm, absolutely. So in terms of who might be the best fit for the roster for Audium as like a service, what are some of the criteria that, if someone's listening to this right now and they're wondering, you know, am I eligible or would I, you know, potentially be a good fit for it? What do you guys look for specifically?
Well, really, really the only criteria is that your music is up on the service and there's some demand for it. And by demand, I mean, like, you have a couple thousand streams. As you may be aware, there's been recent changes in that a sound recording to earn sound recording royalties now has to get at least 1,000 streams in a month, and until otherwise that money sits there. Now, that it's sometimes you can think as 1,000 is a lot or 1,000, but at the end of the day, is you to make like $5, it's something like you need like, I want to say, if to even make like a dime, it's something like 5,000 plays. So it's not like, you know, they're gonna pay you until you make at least $5 anyway. So you're really not missing out on anything then. But so that's kind of a tier. It's like, you know, like people go, I have 10,000 views on YouTube. Now YouTube has one of the lowest rates. So that's, at this point, YouTube won't even let you monetize your own channel if you don't have like 10,000 subscribers. So, right, once again, that seems like a lot, but remember, this is global and billions of people potentially. So it, from a percentage point of view, it's pretty low. But, and you know, these things generate whatever. But so you'll kind of know if you have traction, if something going on. So that's, first of all, that's kind of like the sort of the entry level piece. But then we go all, like I said, all on up to legendary big titles. The only thing that would stop you is that you've assigned these rights or sold these rights to somebody else. Or, and most importantly, if, like, say you have a co-writer, that means you only control half the song. You have complete control over your half of the composition, but the end of the day is you can only sign up half your song. So, which is fine, but a lot of people don't realize. Or if you're doing a cover, that means you don't have the publishing, right? That's another thing. If you do mostly like arrangements of public domain songs, like, you know, like old Christmas songs or just the, like classical pieces that are in the public domain, you are allowed to copyright your specific arrangement, but you can't go and say, I wrote Jingle Bells and I collect 100%. And now you're allowed to collect Jingle Bells as arranged by me. And it's this particular recording in which I've, you know, I've done it in the round and I've adjusted, you know, and it's like, I've, you know, whatever. So, in that case, you would actually do a derivative work that could be original too. But so there's just those kind of things. I'm trying not to give too many examples because they're uncommon. Like you can't claim I wrote a song that uses a sample if you haven't cleared the sample, for example. You know, you can't go, oh, I wrote this great song that's based on a Beatles song. Well, sorry, you actually, you might be able to get away with distributing the song if you assign all of the royalties to say that it's, you know, your version. But at the Sony, who controls the Beatles catalog, could say, no, that's a derivative work. You don't have permission. Take it down. And in fact, we will sue you. You know, there was a famous example from 20 years ago now with Danger Mouse and Jay-Z, where they took the sound recordings of the White Album and put the Jay-Z Black Album on top of it and put it out as the Gray Album. Right. And it's actually very cool, but it's never been legally cleared and released. So it's just one of those things that floats around in the black market. So
here's maybe an interesting one for you. Obviously, right now we're in an interesting place as it relates to like NFTs and blockchain collectibles, and for good reason. You know, there's been like a market crash with NFTs. There's like gifts of hamsters that were selling for millions of dollars. I'm still of the mind that there's an opportunity for musicians and, you know, for some sort of marketplace that creates limited editions of the music that they could sell to fans. In fact, you know, that's one of the platforms that we're working on right now and building for artists to offer direct to their fans to have ownership of these collectibles. And I'd be curious, in terms of royalties and legalities, what would be the proper way for an artist if they, for example, did a cover song of a different song, and they created a what we call relics or like a limited edition version of it, and they sold the relic. And let's just imagine that it came with a video of them performing the song as well, and there's 10 of them available, but they sold 10 of them. From a copyright and royalties point of view, what are your thoughts on that?
So I'm going to I certainly have a lot of experience here, but I'm not a lawyer, so please consult your expert on this. But so you've actually dropped quite a few rights that would be needed, right? So now if it's an original work, you control it all and you get to decide, right? So there's no issue. There is essentially no exchange of royalties there, because if you charged $100 for it, that entire $100 comes to you after you pay whatever costs you, right, to make it, whatever the ingredients in your cake. Like, you have to pay for the eggs still, but you now own the cake. So there is no royalty flow, because it's a direct descent. There's 10 of them. You made $1,000 because you sold 10 of them. All that money goes in your pocket, and out of that money, you had to recover what it cost you to create it. In the case of, once you say cover song, there is, you've introduced what things you can use and what things you can't use without permission. So you've made an audio recording that falls under what the original thing I mentioned. There is a compulsory rate in the United States and a statutory rate. That is, you're making an audio only recording. Let's assume, right, I'm assuming this is a digital package that will be delivered. We're talking NFT, right? So the thing you're going to love, that rate is 9.1 cents. Now, there's a little incremental growth on those, so it might be 10 cents at this point, but you would look what the year current rate is. You would pay 10 cents. You're good. That's it. You just have to report, I sold 10 of these at 10 cents each. Here's your dollar. You have to get a license for it, which is relatively easy to do. You could probably even, go to like the Harry Fox agency. And I'm making a digital, which is essentially a download of this. and I'm making 10 of them. Now, that's it. Now, once you introduce the video component of it, now there is no such thing as a compulsory license. You have to get permission and you have to negotiate what the rate is. So now you're doing a, let's keep the Bob Dylan thing going. It's owned by Universal now. He had sold the catalog there. So you need to go hopefully get someone on the phone from Universal, then get a negotiation with them going, I want to do this thing. And you have to explain what it is. It's almost, think about it as, I've made this movie and I want to put this song in that scene. It's almost the exact same thing. It's like, well, what kind of movie is it? Is there a political message? I don't want anything associated with alcohol or cigarettes. So is anybody smoking in the scene? Right. They own it. They're the creatives in that case. And you want to use their piece of creative in the same way you would want to defend your own piece of creation. I don't want someone, you know, my politics are left and you're going to put this in a right wing thing. I don't want that without, you know, I don't want on there. I want to say no, but oh, you're supporting my candidate. Oh, absolutely. You can use it for free. You know, you have completely different, complete freedom on that one. So that becomes the problem there.
It's interesting that that case exists for videos, but not for, like, you know, creating the music. I mean, I guess we have more creative freedom with, like, sync with a video if it is a movie or if there's a narrative behind it that maybe the audio. But I can see someone, I don't know, like creating an audio only version where they're sneaking in their, you know, political agenda within the audio only.
But see, if you're changing it now, that opens another can of worms. Now, even if you're doing a cover. If a cover would be, it's true to the original. That doesn't mean it has to be note for note or whatever. It just, you're like, I'm trying to think of some of the examples where people say, you've changed it enough, it's a problem. Like, there was a band called the Stray Cats that covered an old 50s song by the artist Eddie Cochran. And they swear in it. And there was no swear in the original Eddie Cochran version. And the estate of Eddie Cochran was like, look, we are very religious. We do not like swearing. We're going to sue you. You didn't get permission to do a derivative work. You've changed it significantly enough. And, you know, you could imagine even just one word, it being a swear, would cross that line that you can't do it. And it's once again, now you're getting into the area of almost like sampling, where I'm going to use the riff from this new song as the bait for you to hear my rap, or, you know, whatever else you want to put in there. You can't do that. You need permission. You've changed enough. So you can't integrate it into that message, right? Because you've changed it enough. Yeah.
So that makes sense. So you can't just like warp things.
I could say this gets really complicated with lawyers too. But parodies are perfectly fine, but a parody is very specific, right? And there's also educational uses. Like, there's some argument. It's like, well, if I'm playing the song in my video to teach someone how to play it, is that educational? And then sometimes people make up their own rules. Well, if I use less than a 30-second clip in my podcast, it's perfectly fine. You know, it's like this is where the law and creative and people try to get around it. And because, like, for example, like a you know, there's those create your own radio station where, you know, I say I like Hey Jude by the Beatles, and then they create a whole radio station around it, right? And as a result, you can't, it's different than a Spotify playlist where I could select all the songs that are going to be on my radio station in a row versus I'm allowed to skip three times in an hour on my radio station. There is no law that says three times in an hour is within range, but it's just become accepted practice. Because once you are able to change every single song, then there's a mechanical in there and you're have to pay the 9 cents per song kind of thing, right? Versus you only have to play the performance piece, because we even get there is, right, there's a public performance piece, and that's where it's played in the gym or even on a streaming service or on a radio station. That's where you sign up with your ASCAP BMI CSAC to collect the performance piece of it, which Audium doesn't do. Like that, there's a lot of protection of the songwriter there, where the songwriter could go and collect their piece and they split the song in half, where there's a publishing share and a songwriter piece. And that's where the performing rights organizations work. So I, this is why it's just so complicated. It's hard to get it all down. You almost just need to know that if someone hits play on my song, five different ways I get paid. Am I set up to collect all five if I control all five? So, And that's where, and then that collecting that is where Audium comes in. So.
Fantastic. Awesome. So, and just to put a wrap on the Music Relic discussion around, mm-hmm. if I understand what you're saying correctly, that, you know, if someone was going to do a cover song, it's a little bit easier if it was just audio only, because they could, you know, just pay the fee, you know, the 9 cents a song, the mechanical.
It's called a mechanical license. You get a mechanical license, you get a fee. Yeah. Because that's, and that was established in the 1915 or something like that. So that was the introduction of a piano roll, like these old piano players. And it was like, how do I get a piece of that? So that has been relevant up until streaming happened. Like, nothing's changed about the law or how you got paid until streaming happened. And that's, you know, that complicated things.
Yeah, but then when you introduce like the video aspect into it, then it becomes like, you know, a much larger discussion, more complicated around the legalities of it. I mean, I know that YouTube has some interesting arrangements where you can do cover songs on YouTube because they've worked it out, right?
Yes. So similar to, right? So the end of the day, it's kind of like the mass access to technology, right? So when they started putting music in a movie, you know, in the late 1920s, it was like, oh, I wrote the song, or, you know, you want to use a hit song that I wrote. And it wasn't like I was hired to write the music and the song. That's when it's like, okay, well, come to me and we negotiate it. And for decades and decades and decades, the amount of volume of things that came out, right, TV commercials and movies, was controlled enough that you actually reasonably could negotiate it. I'm going to do, right? It was in the tens of thousands, right? Let's call it that, right? Over the years, how many movies came out a year, right? And then it started ramping up, obviously, with music videos, but the music videos came out of the record companies that already had a license and a relationship with the song. So it was just like, and we didn't want to do a video. Great. Okay. The fee for that is this, or it's included as promotional because we'll sell more records, you know? So that went along. But then YouTube shows up, and all of us are now, you know, there's literally, I hear something where there's something like 50 days of content that go up every hour, like you would take, you know, on YouTube. So, and so much of that contains music. So there was a lawsuit that came out of that where it was like, you have to negotiate. And YouTube successfully said, well, YouTube doesn't have to. The kid who uploaded that song in their skateboard video has to negotiate with you. And now it goes from, okay, YouTube, you pay us and we negotiate, or it becomes, wow, now it's 50 days of music every hour we have to negotiate with, or 50 hours of video, right? So it became impossible. So it was, it almost became a, the YouTube won the lawsuit saying it wasn't their responsibility. It was their platform. They weren't putting up any copyrighted material. They just had a place where copyrighted material could be put up. And every single person that uploaded, if you know, when you got to read the fine print, you check the box, you said you have permission. So you've lied to YouTube. It's not YouTube's fault. You've told Google you're allowed to do it. And so that's, and so you violate it. And then it became, as some of you might be old enough to remember, the whole, every Napster users were being sued. And, you know, Metallica famously went after these people, and they looked bad. They were perfectly right, but it looks bad, right? You're suing your fans, right? And so it's kind of like, I like your song, I'm going to sue you because you put it up on video. So it was sort of thing. And so there's sort of a compromise. Google wanted music on their platform. It was successful to them. They make money. The more that goes up, they want to make a good user experience. So it became, there's a general agreement out there that all of the music publishers sign into, that you're allowed to put the music up there. As a result, they get a piece of the advertising revenue that's included in, you know, the pre-roll or the ads around it that Google sells. And you get paid for that. And so the more your videos watch, there's more impressions, the more ad revenue it generates for Google, the more money you collect. And you still retain the right going, hey, you've put your music up in a political ad. I don't want to. I'm going to say take it down. I have the right to take it down. Now, that's the thing, is you could send a notice to YouTube, whereas you have someone like Audium working for you. You could just let us know and we could block it in the first way. And so even before the user puts something up, we could make sure it's not available. You always have the right to do a takedown, and we could actually block things directly, whereas you'd be more reliant on a takedown notice for YouTube for them to take it, which frequently becomes whack-a-mole because then someone just puts it in a different video and puts it back up again. So that's been, that's one, and that case has actually kind of opened the marketplace. So it's become a bit of the, it used to be, you have a new service, you can't have my music. End of story. You have to negotiate with it. But now it's become, it's moved from a, I'm going to do it, it's popular, sue me, I'll beg forgiveness, I'll write you a check, and then we're good going forward. That, those days of the Wild West that YouTube was part of is over. Now it's like, you can't launch your service until you have a licensing deal in place. And now there is a marketplace where you go to Audium and you go, we're looking to put this up. It's like, great, you could use our catalog. We want a percentage of revenue. It's common, this, blah, blah. It's 30% or 50% or whatever. We participate, and then all of our songs are fine to be on those services. And the same is true with all the majors and all this. So that's another reason why you want to be, you're sort of part of that business development of the growing market, is your catalog is already, is considered part of the Audium negotiation to make music available on these services. So, you know, so that it's, you know, we become a business development team too. And sometimes we say no, because we just like, you know what, this is a crappy deal. It, like, if Universal Music comes back and says yes, then we maybe we'll have a conversation, because certainly it looks bad to us. And if they're able to beat you up for a better rate, I want the same rate. You know, then we'll think about it. Or you paid them in advance. Well, percentage wise, we want an advance of money that we'll pay out to our clients too. So it makes you part of a bigger group. You get the clout. Once again, you're not giving up the ownership. You know, you're not, it's kind of a, it's a good fake it till you make it place. And even if you make it, you keep more in your pocket too. So.
Awesome. Well, John, man, thank you for coming back on the podcast and sharing some of your genius zone and expertise around, you know, this area that, you know, for a lot of us, I think is, you know, complicated, because it is a complicated thing, but it definitely feels good to know that there's people like yourself and companies like Audium that are helping to demystify it and allow us to, as artists, to focus on being creative and making the music. So, you know, thank you for taking the time to be here. And for those of us who are interested in checking out Audium, or you potentially signing up if we think that we're eligible for it, what's the best place to go to dive deeper?
If you go to audium.com, there is a, it's like get started button, and you'll go through the questionnaire. Like I said, we also, you know, we handle sound recordings, deliver them to YouTube as well. And while we haven't really rolled it out, like I said, we're sort of moving all of the various pieces of what is called the CSAC Music Services. We're going to roll that out. So it'll be much more of a service offering rather than Audium does this and this. So you'll see that happening over the course of the year. And so if you have additional needs, you could always go to, csacmusicgroup.com, and you could see like the wide range of stuff. We have things that specialize in, you know, religious music, library music. There's a lot of things. If you do various things, we're much more, Audium is much more in the sort of the creator hub community that can help probably a lot of the people that are participating in this in the modern music musician studio.
Awesome. Fantastic. Yeah. And I'm personally, you know, interested in connecting more related to having like a catalog of musicians and services that, you know, can you plug into the resource that you've built with Audium. So looking forward to talking more about that. And yeah, on behalf of all of us, yeah, again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing some of the insights and lessons that you've learned over the past 40 plus years.
Well, thank you so much. If anybody, I'll be at South by Southwest next week. I know this might be archived, but we actually have some notice. I will be there all next week. Come by the CSAC event on Tuesday afternoon, March 12th at the Sidebar in Austin, Texas. So maybe I'll get to meet some of you. It'd be great.
Awesome. All right, well, let's do a virtual round of applause. Hey, it's Michael here. I hope that you got a ton of value out of this episode. Make sure to check out the show notes to learn more about our guest today. And if you want to support the podcast, then there's a few ways to help us grow. First, if you hit subscribe, then I'll make sure you don't miss a new episode. Secondly, if you share it with your friends or on your social media and tag us, that really helps us out. And third, best of all, if you leave us an honest review, it's going to help us reach more musicians like you who want to take their music careers to the next level. The time to be a modern musician is now, and I look forward to seeing you on our next episode.